Disc 17.
By the time he received Washington's letter on August 3rd, Hamilton had already posted one to Mount Vernon, urging Washington to stand for re-election and warning him that failure to do so would be deplored as the greatest evil that could befall the country at the present juncture. Washington's letter must have reinforced Hamilton's fear that the government was encircled by enemies and that Jefferson was plotting his ouster. Before Hamilton replied, he published a stinging critique of Jefferson in the Gazette of the United States. Under the guise of an American, Hamilton raised the stakes markedly by naming names. Freneau's newspaper, he alleged, had been set up to advance Jefferson's views, and Madison had been the intermediary in bringing Freneau to Philadelphia. Hamilton engaged in some wicked mockery, noting that the only foreign language the translator Freneau knew was French, and that Jefferson was already acquainted with that language. He then expressly accused Jefferson of disloyalty. "Is it possible that Mr. Jefferson, the head of a principal department of the government, can be the patron of a paper, the evident object of which is to decry the government and its measures?" Many readers must have guessed the identity of the author hiding behind the mask of an American. Now in the fray, Hamilton published two more installments of An American on August 11th and 18th, elaborating on the impropriety of Jefferson's relationship with Freneau. "It is a fact known to every man who approaches that officer that he arraigns the principal measures of the government, and, it may be added, with indiscreet, if not indecent, warmth." Even as Hamilton fired these broadsides, he composed a 14,000-word letter to Washington, vindicating his Treasury tenure. He confessed to deep hurt at the false charges hurled against him. He could endure criticisms of his judgment, but not of his integrity. "I feel that I merit them in no degree, and expressions of indignation sometimes escape me in spite of every effort to suppress them." Hamilton listed his economic feats in office. He talked of the steep drop in the interest rates that the United States had to pay for loans, from 6% to 4%, and the influx of foreign money that had financed commerce and agriculture. Abundant money was now available for legitimate business purposes. Even speculation had proved his system's soundness, for under a bad system, the public stock would have been too uncertain an article for people to speculate in it. Hamilton denied that any member of Congress can properly be called a stock jobber or a paper dealer, even if some had invested in government debt. Many had bought bank stock after the founding of the Bank of the United States, and he saw nothing wrong with that. It irked Hamilton that Jefferson claimed a monopoly on morality, and he made the following retort to his adversary. "As to the love of liberty and country, you have given no stronger proofs of being actuated by it than I have done. Cease then to arrogate to yourself and to your party all the patriotism and virtue of the country." For all its brilliance, the zeal of Hamilton's letter must have heightened Washington's worries about the schism in his administration. In late August, he sent Hamilton a melancholy reply, pleading for mutual tolerance between him and Jefferson. Aware of the accusations they were trading in the press, Washington regretted these wounding suspicions and irritating charges and asked for healing measures to restore harmony. The president feared that if the acrimony continued, the Union itself might dissolve. Political life in the young republic now presented a strange spectacle. The intellectual caliber of the leading figures surpassed that of any future political leadership in American history. On the other hand, their animosity toward one another has seldom been exceeded either. How to explain this mix of elevated thinking and base slander? As mentioned, both sides believed that the future of the country was at stake. By 1792, both political parties saw their opponents as mortal threats to the heritage of the Revolution. But the special mixture of idealism and vituperation also stemmed from the experiences of the founders themselves. These selfless warriors of the Revolution and sages of the Constitutional Convention had been forced to descend from their Olympian heights and adjust to a rougher world of everyday politics, where they cultivated their own interests and tried to capitalize on their former glory. In consequence, the Founding Fathers all appear to us in two guises: as both sublime and ordinary, selfless and selfish, heroic and humdrum. After the unity of 1776 and 1787, they had become wildly competitive and sometimes jealous of one another. It is no accident that our most scathing portraits of them come from their own pens. Far from heeding Washington's call to desist from attacking Jefferson, Hamilton stepped up his efforts. Increasingly bitter, he was incapable of the forbearance Washington requested. The day before he replied to Washington on September 9th, Hamilton found himself reeling from another fresh burst of articles against him. An author named Aristides, the name of an Athenian motivated by love of country, not mercenary gain, deified Jefferson as the decided opponent of aristocracy, monarchy, hereditary succession, a titled order of nobility, and all the other mock pageantry of kingly government. He implied that Hamilton had endorsed these abhorrent things when, in fact, he had always condemned them. Noting the anonymous nature of Hamilton's diatribes, the author likened the Treasury Secretary to a cowardly assassin who strikes in the dark and securely wounds because he is unseen. Freneau's National Gazette continued to lambaste the Federalists as the monarchical party, the moneyed aristocracy, and monocrats. None of this likely to induce a mood of remorse in Hamilton. In his September 9th letter, Hamilton applauded Washington's attempts at reconciliation, then insisted that he hadn't started the feud, that he was the injured party, and that he was not to blame. He took the feud a step further by recommending that Jefferson be expelled from the cabinet. I do not hesitate to say that, in my opinion, the period is not remote when the public good will require substitutes for the differing members of your administration. As long as it had not undermined the government, Hamilton said, he had tolerated Jefferson's backstabbing. That was no longer the case. I cannot doubt, from the evidence that I possess, that the National Gazette was instituted by him, Jefferson, for political purposes, and that one leading object of it has been to render me and all the measures connected with my department as odious as possible. Hamilton thought it his duty to unmask this anti-government coterie and draw aside the veil from the principal actors. To this strong impulse, I have yielded. In an astounding statement, Hamilton told Washington that he could not desist from newspaper attacks against Jefferson. I find myself placed in a situation not to be able to recede for the present. Never before had Hamilton refused such a direct request from Washington, and not since quitting the general's wartime staff had he so willfully asserted his own independence. Even while telling Washington that he would try to abide by any truce, he was preparing his next press tirade. The furious exchanges between Hamilton and Jefferson had hardened into a mutual vendetta that Washington was powerless to stop. Nor did Jefferson heed Washington's large-spirited plea for tolerance. In replying to the presidential request, he renewed his withering critique of Hamilton's system, which, he said, flowed from principles adverse to liberty and was calculated to undermine and demolish the Republic by creating an influence of his department over the members of the legislature. He charged Hamilton with favoring a king and a House of Lords at the Constitutional Convention, a misconstruction of what Hamilton had said. With greater justice, he grumbled about Hamilton's unauthorized meetings with British and French ministers, but he also displayed an ugly condescension toward Hamilton that he ordinarily concealed. I will not suffer my retirement to be clouded by the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country which has not only received him and given him bread, but heaped its honors on his head. The comment smacked of aristocratic disdain for the self-made man. In fact, no immigrant in American history has ever made a larger contribution than Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton seemed unhinged by the dispute. In the still-secret Reynolds affair, he had shown a lack of private restraint. Now, something compulsive and uncontrollable appeared in his public behavior. A captive of his emotions, he revealed an irrepressible need to respond to attacks. Whenever he tried to suppress these emotions, they burst out and overwhelmed him. Throughout that fall, the argumentative Treasury Secretary donned disguises and published blazing articles behind Roman pen names. Henceforth, he provided a running newspaper commentary on his own administration. Since he saw both his personal honor and the Republic's future at stake, he fought with his full arsenal of verbal weapons. Again and again in his career, Hamilton committed the same political error. He never knew when to stop, and the resulting excesses led him into irremediable indiscretions. In a new tack, Hamilton carried the battle into enemy territory, the pages of the National Gazette itself. 2 days after telling Washington that he could not stop his polemics, he appeared twice in Freneau's paper. As Civis, he warned of a Jeffersonian cabal trying to win power at the next election. In Fact Number 1, he corrected the continuing Jeffersonian distortions of his belief that a national debt could be a national blessing. He denied that government debt was a good thing at all times and held that particular and temporary circumstances might render that advantageous at one time, which at another might be hurtful. He also charged the Jeffersonians with hypocrisy for opposing both taxes and debt. A certain description of men are for getting out of debt, yet are against all taxes for raising money to pay it off. Within a week, Hamilton had returned to his ideological home, Freneau's Gazette of the United States, publishing a new series under the name Catullus. He had the cheek to praise himself handsomely, saying that the Treasury Secretary feared no examination of his motives. I mistake, however, the man if he fears the strictest scrutiny into his political principles and conduct. As before, Hamilton limned Jefferson as a despot in disguise, masking political ambitions behind Republican simplicity. He contended that Jefferson had first opposed the Constitution, then adopted it from expediency. Hamilton didn't stop with politics and now slashed at Jefferson's personal reputation. Hinting that he possessed darker knowledge of his subject's life, Hamilton intimated that Jefferson was a closet libertine. Mr. Jefferson has hitherto been distinguished as the quiet, modest, retiring philosopher, as the plain, simple, unambitious Republican. He shall not now for the first time be regarded as the intriguing incendiary, the aspiring, turbulent competitor. Catullus said that Jefferson's true nature had not been exposed before. But there is always a first time when characters studious of artful disguises are unveiled, when the visor of Stoicism is plucked from the brow of the Epicurean, when the plain garb of Quaker simplicity is stripped from the concealed voluptuary, when Caesar coyly refusing the proffered diadem is seen to be Caesar rejecting the trappings but tenaciously gripping the substance of imperial domination. Hamilton was pointing to some deeper knowledge of Jefferson's private life, perhaps his knowledge of Jefferson's liaison with Sally Hemings, based on reports from Angelica Church. Notably, Hamilton again used Julius Caesar as an example of the worst sort of tyrant, not as history's greatest man. In responding to Washington's call for toleration, the only difference between Hamilton and Jefferson was that Hamilton wielded his own pen while Jefferson employed proxies. Between September 26th and December 31st, 1792, 6 essays entitled A Vindication of Mr. Jefferson came out in the American Daily Advertiser. Jefferson's protege from Virginia, Senator James Monroe, wrote 5 of them, and Madison the 6th. The two men had conferred at length with Jefferson at Monticello, and Jefferson sent 7 letters to Madison, which Monroe drew freely on in his articles. Monroe tried to exculpate Jefferson from charges that he had opposed the Constitution and wished to repudiate the national debt. In one essay, A Candid State of Parties, Madison described the Hamiltonians as more partial to the opulent than to the other classes of society, and said they wanted to conduct government by the pageantry of rank, the influence of money and emoluments, and the terror of military force. Before writing the article, Madison received word from John Beckley, clerk of the House of Representatives, that Hamilton had declared unequivocally that Madison was his personal and political enemy. Things had reached a frenzied state that would have been inconceivable to Hamilton and Madison 5 years earlier when they started the Federalist. Before breakfast on the morning of October 1st, 1792, Jefferson met with George Washington at Mount Vernon and again tried to convince him that Hamilton headed a monarchist plot. According to Jefferson, Hamilton had told him that the Constitution was a shilly-shally thing of mere milk and water, which could not last and was only good as a step to something better. Washington now lost all patience with Jefferson and his obsessive belief in a non-existent plot. He told him that, as to the idea of transforming this government into a monarchy, he did not believe there were 10 men in the United States whose opinions were worth attention who entertained such a thought. Washington also made it plain that he supported Hamilton's funding system because it had worked. That for himself he had seen our affairs desperate and our credit lost, and that this was in a sudden and extraordinary degree raised to the highest pitch, Jefferson later wrote. Washington said that it did not bother him that some legislators owned government debt because some self-interest was inescapable in any government. Because the president sided with his much younger rival, Jefferson concluded grumpily that the president's brain must be enfeebled by age, and that his opinions showed a willingness to let others act and even think for him. In despair, Jefferson repeated his intention to retire from the State Department at the end of Washington's first term, March 1793, though he was to linger until the end of that year. Hamilton had flowered in office and found his identity there, while Jefferson hated the paperwork, had wearied of contesting administration policies, and daydreamed about a return to more peaceful pursuits at Monticello. The job had trapped him among political enemies, and he knew it would be easier to build up his following outside of office. There was no longer any point in trying to convert George Washington. Alexander Hamilton had won. Chapter 21. Exposure. The turbulent events of 1792, the rise of political parties, the newspaper wars, the furious intramural fights with Jefferson, should have made Alexander Hamilton extra vigilant about threats to his reputation. Now, at the apex of his power, the 37-year-old Treasury Secretary had enemies ready to exploit his every failing. Despite this vulnerability, he continued his affair with Maria Reynolds and went on paying hush money to James Reynolds. His moral laxity and absurd willingness to risk exposure at such a moment remain a baffling conundrum. Adding danger was the sudden appearance of a menacing new spectator, Jacob Clingman, a friend of James Reynolds and a former clerk of the erstwhile House Speaker Frederick Muhlenberg of Pennsylvania. Arriving at the Reynolds home one day, Clingman was stunned to discover Alexander Hamilton leaving. Several days later, Clingman beheld another dreamlike tableau. He was alone with Maria Reynolds when someone rapped at the door and the Treasury Secretary entered. Perhaps startled by Clingman's presence, Hamilton pretended ridiculously that he was delivering a message. He handed Maria a slip of paper, explaining that he had been ordered to give it to her by her husband, and left. The stupefied Clingman wondered how James Reynolds could boss around America's second most powerful man. Responding to his inquiries afterward, Maria Reynolds boasted that Hamilton had paid her husband upwards of $1,100. James Reynolds likewise bragged to Clingman that he had gotten money from Hamilton for speculation. An arch critic of Hamilton's policies, Clingman was predisposed to see such payments as proof of Hamilton conniving with speculators in government securities. On one occasion, Clingman accompanied James Reynolds to visit Hamilton, waited outside, then watched his companion emerge with $100. This certified his suspicion of Hamilton's venality. Hamilton claimed that he had tried to terminate his liaison with Maria Reynolds. Whenever he told her that he wanted to break off the relationship, this femme fatale responded with sighs, groans, and weepy theatrics. She would beg to see him one last time and hint that if denied her wishes, frightful consequences might ensue. "Yes, sir, rest assured I will never ask you to call on me again. I have kept my bed those 2 days and now rise from my pillow, which your neglect has filled with the sharpest thorns. I no longer doubt what I have dreaded to know, but stop. I do not wish to see you to say anything about my late disappointments. No, I only do it to ease a heart which is ready burst with grief. I can neither eat or sleep. I have been on the point of doing the most horrid acts, and I shudder to think where I might been, what will become of me. In vain I try to call reason to aid me, but alas, there is no comfort for me. Mariah's maid was kept busy bustling through the night, relaying such erratic notes. One can only imagine Hamilton's cold sweats and unremitting horror at the thought of discovery by Eliza, who was now pregnant with their fifth child. James Reynolds followed current events, and his threatening letters often coincided with key episodes in Hamilton's public life. Reynolds thought that Hamilton was an unscrupulous official who had given William Dewar money for speculation and secretly made $30,000 from their illicit relationship, false information that he passed along to Clingman. So in late March 1792, as Hamilton grappled with financial panic in New York, James Reynolds forced him to grapple with turmoil in his private life. The day after Dewar was imprisoned, both James and Mariah Reynolds wrote to Hamilton and tightened the noose. They acted their roles to perfection. James, the strong but aggrieved husband who had lost his wife's affections because of Hamilton, and Mariah, the fickle, confused wife, hopelessly smitten with her lover, who gave way to operatic ravings and invocations of her cruel fortune. Did Hamilton find it poignant or merely grotesque that she still addressed him in writing as Colonel Hamilton and Sir? In the letters sent after Dewar's arrest, Mariah Reynolds spouted poppycock about how she was doomed to drink the bitter cup of affliction and how death now would be welcome. She renewed her pleas for another visit. Simultaneously, James Reynolds told Hamilton that he had no wish to harm him, but demanded satisfaction for his loss of domestic felicity. "I find whenever you have been with her, she is cheerful and kind," James Reynolds explained to Hamilton. "But when you have not in some time, she is quite to reverse, and wishes to be alone by herself." This disturbed him, of course, as a loving husband. Mariah had told Hamilton that her husband wished to meet him the next evening, so James Reynolds explained, with elaborate mock courtesy, that he hoped to convince Hamilton that "I would not wish to trifle with you, and would much rather add to the happiness of all than to distress any." Whatever happened at this meeting, it only emboldened James Reynolds to demand more money. At first, he did so with a cringing humility. A week later, this master of malapropisms wrote to Hamilton, "Sir, I hope you will pardon me in taking the liberty I do in troubling you so often. It hurts me to let you know my said evasion. I should take it as a prodigaler if you will oblige me with the loan of about $30. I want it for some little necessaries of life for my family, sir." To give a thin veneer of legality to his extortion, Reynolds pretended to be a proud family man who needed loans to tide him over tough times. He even gave Hamilton receipts and promised to repay the loans. 4 days later, Reynolds again requested money, this time for $45. The blackmailer was becoming more brazen. In a reply written without salutation or signature, Hamilton told Reynolds of his scarcity of cash and informed him, with mounting anger, "Tomorrow what is requested will be done. 'Twill hardly be possible today." The man who felt no need to placate Thomas Jefferson or James Madison had to grovel before the raffish James Reynolds, whom he later described bitterly as an obscure, unimportant, and profligate man. He was so frightened of Reynolds that he wrote to him in disguised handwriting, lest Reynolds use it as the engine of a false credit or turn it to some other sinister use, Hamilton said. On April 17, 1792, Reynolds informed Hamilton that his adulterous romance with Mariah had destroyed their marriage. "She has treated me more cruel than pen can't paint out, and says that she is determined never to be a wife to me any more." In his most self-effacing mode, Reynolds said that he would not chide Hamilton. "I freely forgive you, and don't wish to give you fear or pain a moment on the account of it." On the other hand, he continued, it lay in Hamilton's power to make some amends, and he said that he would come to Hamilton's office, which must have made the latter quake. 6 days later, Reynolds demanded another $30 and said he would await an answer at Hamilton's office. In his letters, James Reynolds began to dispense with the fake, effusive professions of friendship and got straight down to business. On May 2, 1792, James Reynolds sent Hamilton a letter that fully awakened him to the dire threat to his career. Hamilton already had political troubles enough. He was about to attend an emergency meeting to rescue the Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures from William Dewar's embezzlement. In this letter, Reynolds explained that he had hoped Mariah's infatuation for Hamilton would gradually subside. Since this had not happened, Reynolds declared he would prohibit Hamilton from visiting her. Reynolds also reproached Hamilton for always sneaking in the back door of their house, as if he was ashamed to visit them. With a flamboyant show of self-pity, Reynolds asked, "Am I a person of such a bad character that you would not wish to be seen in coming in my house in the front way?" It now dawned on Hamilton belatedly that the blackmail scheme might have a political dimension. He remembered the accidental encounter with Jacob Clingman at the Reynolds house. Were his enemies trying to entrap him? Years later, Hamilton described the May 2nd letter as a masterpiece. "The husband there forbids my future visits to his wife, chiefly because I was careful to avoid publicity. It was probably necessary to the project of some deeper treason against me that I should be seen at the house. Hence was it contrived, with all the caution on my part to avoid it, that Jacob Clingman should occasionally see me." It is strange and almost inconceivable that a man of Hamilton's cynical worldliness should have taken so long to fathom this danger. Sadly, it was the perceived threat to his career, not regret over his pregnant wife, that restored Hamilton to his senses. He finally mustered sufficient willpower and steeled himself against Mariah Reynolds' further entreaties. Her last attempt came on June 2, 1792. "Dear sir, I once take up the pen to solicit the favor of seeing again, oh, Colonel Hamilton, what have I done that you should thus neglect me?" This garbled note was followed by a fresh letter from James Reynolds, asking for $300 to invest in shares of the new Lancaster Turnpike. Instead of appeasing Reynolds, Hamilton replied tersely, "It is utterly out of my power, I assure you, upon my honor, to comply with your request. Your note is returned." Rebuffed, Reynolds reduced his demand to $50 and threw in a frightening new touch, saying that he would stop by Hamilton's house that evening. The Treasury Secretary paid up, but it was the last time Reynolds extorted money from him. Hamilton probably thought the whole nightmarish episode had ended when it had only just begun. Incredibly, he had allowed this affair, enacted in the heart of the nation's capital, to proceed for almost a year. In a letter to a Federalist politician that September, Hamilton continued to present himself as a paragon of virtue, saying, "I pledge myself to you and to every friend of mine that the strictest scrutiny into every part of my conduct, whether as a private citizen or as a public officer, can only serve to establish the perfect purity of it." The Treasury Secretary, it turned out, did protest too much. During the summer of 1792, Hamilton was preoccupied with exposing Freneau's link with Jefferson and Madison and winning the internecine cabinet warfare. He had neither the time nor inclination to dally with Mariah Reynolds, and this ruined James Reynolds' plans. The blackmailing couple had moved to a large house on Vine Street near the corner of Fifth and hoped to cover costs by renting rooms to genteel boarders, as James phrased it. The only snag was that they lacked cash to furnish the rooms. As always, James Reynolds exhibited a keenly sadistic sense of timing. On August 22nd, Eliza Hamilton gave birth to the couple's fifth child, John Church Hamilton. "Mrs. Hamilton has lately given me another boy, who and the mother are unusually well," Hamilton told Washington Secretary Tobias Lear. Perhaps James Reynolds thought that, with a newborn baby, Hamilton might be more easily coerced. On August 24th, he wrote and tried to touch him for another $200. A week later, he wrote again, lamenting that he had received no reply. Since Hamilton had stopped seeing his wife, James Reynolds seemed to have surrendered all power over him. Perhaps feeling guilty over Mariah Reynolds, Hamilton stuck close to home and in one letter that fall referred to his growing and hitherto too much neglected family. The Reynolds affair might never have come to light if James Reynolds and Jacob Klingman had not been charged in mid-November with defrauding the U.S. government of $400. The two swindlers had posed as executors over the estate of a supposedly deceased war veteran, Ephraim Goodenow, who had a claim against the government. In their scheme, Reynolds and Klingman prevailed upon one John Delabar to perjure himself and corroborate their story. Goodenow's name had been selected from a confidential list of soldiers owed money by the government, a list purloined from the Treasury Department. The man who prosecuted Reynolds and Klingman was Oliver Wolcott Jr., who had been named Comptroller of the Treasury the previous year. An admirer of Wolcott's integrity and knowledge, Hamilton had persuaded Washington to appoint him over a competing candidate touted by Jefferson. Reynolds and Klingman ended up in a Philadelphia jail. Because the Treasury Department filed the charges, James Reynolds suspected that Hamilton was engaged in a vendetta. He wrote to Hamilton twice, asking for help, but received no assistance. Hamilton then learned from Wolcott that Reynolds was insinuating loudly that he could make disclosures injurious to the character of some head of a department. Hamilton saw exactly where this was heading and advised Wolcott to keep Reynolds imprisoned until the accusations were cleared up. Released on bail, Jacob Klingman turned to the most powerful man he knew, his former boss, Congressman Frederick Muhlenberg of Pennsylvania. The former House Speaker agreed to intercede on behalf of Klingman, but not Reynolds, whom he had heard was a rascal. He decided to speak with Hamilton in the company of New York Senator Aaron Burr. At the interview, a circumspect Hamilton agreed to do everything consistent with honor to aid Klingman. Muhlenberg persuaded Oliver Wolcott to strike a deal. If Klingman and Reynolds refunded the money defrauded from the government, returned the stolen list of soldiers, and identified the Treasury employee who had leaked the document, then charges against them might be dropped. Evidently, the two men met these conditions by early December 1792. It was certainly of more consequence to the public to detect and expel from the bosom of the Treasury Department an unfaithful clerk to prevent future and extensive mischief than to disgrace and punish two worthless individuals, Hamilton later wrote. The matter might have ended there, except that Klingman kept suggesting darkly to Muhlenberg that he harbored damning information about Hamilton. As Muhlenberg recalled, Klingman, unasked, frequently dropped hints to me that Reynolds had it in his power, very materially, to injure the Secretary of the Treasury, and that Reynolds knew several very improper transactions of his. At first, Muhlenberg scoffed at this. Then Klingman told him that Hamilton was hip-deep in speculation and had provided James Reynolds with money for that illicit purpose. What most impressed Muhlenberg was Reynolds' contention that he had it in his power to hang the Secretary of the Treasury. Muhlenberg did not believe that he could hide such information, and on Wednesday morning, December 12th, he turned to two other Republicans, Senator James Monroe and Representative Abraham B. Venable, both of Virginia. Monroe's entry into the drama was especially ominous for Hamilton, given his recent National Gazette pieces. It is not clear that Hamilton knew that Monroe was the author of these pieces, but he certainly knew of Monroe's intimacy with Jefferson and Madison. Thanks to Mariah Reynolds, Klingman had some unsigned notes sent by Hamilton to James Reynolds, which Muhlenberg now showed to Monroe and Venable. Hardly reluctant to pursue the charges, the Virginians went straight to see James Reynolds in his prison cell. The prisoner teased them with vague but tantalizing hints that he had a person in high office in his power and has had a long time past. He further let drop that Mr. Wolcott was in the same department as this mystery person, and he supposed under his influence or control. Though the allusion to Hamilton was patent, the wily Reynolds said that he would not divulge more information until he was freed. Meanwhile, Mariah Reynolds was scarcely idle. This artful 24-year-old woman seemed able, on short notice, to secure appointments with high officials. She went to see Pennsylvania's governor, Thomas Mifflin, who expressed sympathy with her plight. Mariah Reynolds told Mifflin about, among other things, her love affair with Hamilton. She also took advantage of the situation to visit her illustrious former lover, who was trying to walk a fine line between official propriety and self-protection. On the one hand, Hamilton echoed Wilcott's position that Clingman and James Reynolds should return the list of soldiers to the Treasury along with their ill-gotten money. On the other hand, according to Mariah Reynolds, Hamilton also pressed her to burn his damaging letters to her husband. Fully aware of the value of these notes as an insurance policy, the siren of Philadelphia politics was smart enough to keep two or three. Having no notion of any Hamilton adultery, Muhlenberg and Monroe visited Mariah Reynolds at home on the evening of December 12th, seeking more information about alleged financial collusion between Hamilton and her husband. At first, she was not communicative. Only gradually did she open up about business relations and about how she had burned a large number of signed notes that Hamilton had sent to James Reynolds. She said that Hamilton had promised to aid her and had urged her husband to leave the parts, not to be seen here again, in which case he would give her something clever. She piqued her visitor's curiosity by boasting that her husband could tell something that would make some of the heads of departments tremble. To boost her credibility, she showed them a letter she had received from Hamilton the week before. It was an eventful day in the life of Alexander Hamilton, who knew that influential legislators had grilled James Reynolds that morning. At some time after midnight, having been freed from prison hours earlier, James Reynolds sent a young female messenger to Hamilton's house. Then he and Clingman paced outside, awaiting an answer. The girl emerged with a message that James Reynolds should call on Hamilton in the morning. Shortly after sunrise, Reynolds met Hamilton and left a vivid impression of the distraught Treasury Secretary, who was extremely agitated, walking backward and forward across the room and striking alternately his forehead and thigh. Observing to him that he had enemies at work, but was willing to meet them on fair ground, and requested him not to stay long, lest it might be noticed. Although any account from James Reynolds is suspect, the compulsive pacing and nervous gesticulations were typical of Hamilton. Once the interview was over, James Reynolds vanished from Philadelphia, fleeing either creditors or further prosecution. He had promised Monroe and Venable that he would reveal all at 10 o'clock that morning, but the two Virginian legislators now discovered that he had absconded or concealed himself. The flight of James Reynolds only heightened the suspicions of Muhlenberg, Monroe, and Venable that Hamilton was guilty of official misconduct. They were ready to present their shocking findings to Washington and had already drafted a letter to him. Before sending it, however, they thought it their duty to confront Hamilton with the allegations. On the morning of December 15th, the three-man delegation filed into Hamilton's office, with Muhlenberg taking the lead. Hamilton recalled, "He introduced the subject by observing to me that they had discovered a very improper connection between me and a Mr. Reynolds. Extremely hurt by this mode of introduction, I arrested the progress of the discourse by giving way to very strong expressions of indignation." Faced with Hamilton's wrath, the three legislators reassured him that they were not making any accusations, but felt honor-bound to discuss the matter with him before reporting to Washington. When they showed Hamilton his own handwritten notes to Reynolds, he instantly, and to their amazement, acknowledged their authenticity. He said that if they came to his house that evening, he would clear up the mystery by showing them written documents that would eliminate all doubt as to his innocence. Oliver Wilcott Jr. was also invited to attend the meeting. At home that evening, Alexander Hamilton treated the three Republican legislators to a salacious tale dramatically at odds with the scandalous one they had expected to hear. He had gathered a batch of letters from James and Mariah Reynolds and recounted the history of his extramarital affair. Another man might have been brief or elliptical. Instead, as if in need of some cathartic cleansing, Hamilton briefed them in agonizing detail about how the husband had acted as a bawd for the wife, how the blackmail payments had been made, the loathing the couple had aroused in him, and his final wish to be rid of them. When the three legislators realized that the scandal involved marital infidelity, not government corruption, at least one of them delicately urged me to discontinue it as unnecessary, Hamilton recalled. I insisted upon going through the whole, and did so. They heard the impassioned, run-on letters from Mariah Reynolds and the truculent demands for money from James Reynolds. It was as if Hamilton were both exonerating and flagellating himself at once. The little delegation seemed satisfied with Hamilton's chronicle, if not flustered by the awkward situation. They apologized for having invaded his privacy. In retrospect, Hamilton detected subtle but perceptible differences in their reactions. Mr. Muhlenberg and Mr. Venable in particular manifested a degree of sensibility on the occasion. Mr. Monroe was more cold, but entirely explicit. In a memo the next day, Monroe wrote, "We left Hamilton under an impression our suspicions were removed. He acknowledged our conduct toward him had been fair and liberal. He could not complain of it." Their accusatory letter to Washington was shelved. On the sidewalk afterward, Muhlenberg had drawn Walcott aside and, with genuine sympathy for Hamilton, said that he wished he had not been present to watch his humiliating confession in such an intimate matter. In contrast, Monroe continued to meet with Jacob Clingman. In early January, Clingman complained to him that Hamilton had been exonerated of charges of official corruption. "He further observed to me," Monroe wrote afterward, "that he communicated the same to Mrs. Reynolds, who appeared much shocked at it and wept immoderately." Muhlenberg, Monroe, and Venable had sworn they would keep the incident confidential. Given that the political world of the 1790s was one vast whispering gallery, Hamilton must have wondered if they would indeed honor their pledge. 2 days later, upon reflection, he asked his three interlocutors for copies of the documents they had shown him. In allowing them to make the copies, Hamilton made a critical error, for Monroe entrusted the task to John Beckley, clerk of the House of Representatives. Beckley, the cunning, serviceable Jeffersonian loyalist who figured in so many intrigues against Hamilton, decided to preserve a set of papers for himself. For the rest of his life, Monroe refused to admit that he had violated his confidentiality pledge to Hamilton and provided the documents to Beckley. Thus, by December 17, 1792, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison knew about Hamilton's confrontation with the three legislators. Jefferson chose to misconstrue what had happened, interpreting the event as proof not just of Hamilton's love affair with Mariah Reynolds, but of his venal speculation in government securities, exactly what Hamilton had striven to refute. Beckley continued to ply Monroe and Jefferson with unsubstantiated rumors about the Treasury Secretary. Equally unfortunate for Hamilton was that the man who retained the original papers was James Monroe. Later on, Monroe stated that he had deposited the papers with a friend, that friend being, in all likelihood, Thomas Jefferson. On January 5, 1793, Monroe published his last installment of The Vindication of Mr. Jefferson. He used the piece to telegraph a warning to Hamilton that he would not hesitate, if necessary, to exploit his knowledge of the Reynolds affair. "I shall conclude this paper by observing how much it is to be wished that this writer, that is, Hamilton, would exhibit himself to the public view, that we might behold in him a living monument of that immaculate purity to which he pretends and which ought to distinguish so bold and arrogant a censor of others." Hamilton knew what the snide reference to immaculate purity meant. For the rest of his time as Treasury Secretary, he was shadowed by the awareness that determined enemies had access to defamatory material about his private life. This sword of Damocles, perpetually dangling above his head, may provide one explanation of why he never made a serious bid to succeed Washington as president. The marriage of Alexander and Eliza Hamilton survived the affair, but the marriage between James and Mariah Reynolds did not. In May 1793, Mariah, reverting to Mary, filed for divorce in New York and hired as her lawyer, of all people, Aaron Burr. She now tagged James Reynolds as an unprincipled scoundrel and accused him of having committed adultery on July 10, 1792, with a woman named Eliza Flavinier of Dutchess County, New York. The date is intriguing since it follows by a little more than a month Hamilton's refusal to pay more blackmail money to James Reynolds, suggesting that Mariah may have outlived her usefulness to him. The same day that the divorce became official, Mariah married Jacob Clingman. By representing Mariah Reynolds in this case, Aaron Burr was vouchsafed a glimpse into the disorderly private affairs of Alexander Hamilton, a glimpse that might later have inflamed him when Hamilton raised questions about Burr's own misconduct. And how did Hamilton react to the consequence of his execrable lack of judgment? We have no letters between Alexander and Eliza Hamilton that refer even obliquely to the scandal. But a close reading of Hamilton's writings offers his view of adultery in a most unlikely place, the middle of an unpublished essay written months later on the need for American neutrality in foreign affairs. In one passage, he reiterated his faith in marital fidelity and his knowledge that adultery damaged families and harmed the adulterer as well as the deceived spouse. A dispassionate and virtuous citizen of the United States will scorn to stand on any but purely American ground. To speak figuratively, he will regard his own country as a wife to whom he is bound to be exclusively faithful and affectionate, and he will watch with a jealous attention every propensity of his heart to wander towards a foreign country, which he will regard as a mistress that may pervert his fidelity and mar his happiness. 'Tis to be regretted that there are persons among us who appear to have a passion for a foreign mistress, as violent as it is irregular, and who, in the paroxysms of their love, seem, perhaps without being themselves sensible of it, too ready to sacrifice the real welfare of the political family to their partiality for the object of their tenderness. The Reynolds affair was a sad and inexcusable lapse on Hamilton's part, made only the more reprehensible by his high office, his self-proclaimed morality, his frequently missed chances to end the liaison, and the love and loyalty of his pregnant wife. Chapter 22. Stabbed in the Dark. Even as their feud worsened, both Hamilton and Jefferson pleaded with Washington to stand for a second term as president. It may have been the sole thing that now united these sworn antagonists. Both men knew their personal warfare could wreck the still fragile Union and thought Washington the one man who could hold it together. "North and South will hang together if they have you to hang on," Jefferson told the president. Hamilton had additional motives for seeking a second term for Washington. The president had been his indispensable patron, the steadfast supporter of his policies, granting him preeminent status in the cabinet. In drafting his annual address to Congress that autumn, Washington solicited suggestions from all cabinet members, then assigned the speech to Hamilton. A second term for Washington would aid another Hamiltonian objective: to strengthen executive power. His fears of legislative tyranny had only increased as congressional opposition to him had gathered force. Since Washington's victory seemed almost foreordained, the focus shifted to the vice presidential race. Unable to target the popular president directly, Republicans turned to the vice presidency as a referendum on Washington's first term. Hamilton never wavered in supporting John Adams as vice president, a fact obscured by their later row. Even Abigail Adams, we have seen, cheered on Hamilton as Treasury Secretary. Writing to a Federalist congressman in October 1792, Hamilton conceded that Mr. Adams, like other men, has his faults and his foibles. Faults and foibles that Hamilton himself eventually exposed. He admitted they held some differing views. For all that, Adams was honest, firm, faithful, and independent, a sincere lover of his country, a real friend to genuine liberty. No man's private character can be fairer than his. No man has given stronger proofs than him of disinterested and intrepid patriotism. Such glittering adjectives seldom flowed from Hamilton's captious quill. By nature, Hamilton was a busybody and could not refrain from offering Adams unsolicited advice. The vice president was a Federalist more by default than conviction. He prided himself on his grumpy independence and freedom from party virulence, and saw no need to make common cause with Hamilton. Distressed by rumors that Governor Clinton might challenge Adams for the vice presidency, Hamilton took it upon himself in June 1792 to warn Adams of something very like a design to subvert the government. Among Adams's many quirks was a penchant for extended absences from Philadelphia. By early September, Hamilton feared that Adams's prolonged sojourn at his home in Quincy, Massachusetts, might mar his re-election chances, and he sent him a tactfully worded note urging him to return to the Capitol. His stay in Massachusetts will give some handle to your enemies to misrepresent. And though I am persuaded you are very indifferent personally to the event of a certain election, yet I hope you are not so as it regards the cause of good government. Adams was far from indifferent to the election's outcome. John Furling has noted, there can be little doubt that Adams saw the vice presidency as his best means by which to succeed President Washington. To further that end, he soon eschewed his powdered wig, ceremonial sword, and handsome coach. Irked by Hamilton's advice, Adams did not rush back to Philadelphia. He was vain enough to tell Abigail that it was inconceivable that George Clinton, his inferior in knowledge and government service, could pose a serious political threat. Such was Adams's self-regard that he told son John Quincy during the campaign that his own life story had been one of success almost without example. But the election was to vindicate Hamilton's sense of urgency instead of Adams's complacency. Shortly after Hamilton sent his missive to Adams, he was alerted to an even greater menace than George Clinton. Aaron Burr was letting it be noised about that he was prepared to challenge Adams as the Republican candidate for vice president. The 36-year-old Burr had avid backers in the North, such as Benjamin Rush, who told him that your friends everywhere look to you to take an active part in removing the monarchical rubbish of our government. It is time to speak out, or we are undone. For many in the South, Burr's entry into the race was an unwelcome intrusion. He lacked the depth and experience to oust someone of Adams's stature, and they had lined up regional support for Clinton. Burr's sudden trial balloon created suspicions among prospective Southern allies that were to be confirmed nearly a decade later. It was New York's other senator, Rufus King, who first informed Hamilton that Burr was rounding up key supporters in New England. King feared that Burr might shave 10 votes from Adams's electoral total, and that with his delicate ego, Adams might then feel so degraded by the results that he would decline to serve. If the enemies of the government are secret and united, we shall lose Mr. Adams, King warned Hamilton. Nothing which has heretofore happened so decisively proves the inveteracy of the opposition. Hamilton was determined to have Washington and Adams back for a second term. Events of the previous year had taught him to cast a wary eye on Aaron Burr, whom Adams described as looking fat as a duck and as ruddy as a roost cock. Burr hadn't endeared himself to Hamilton by defeating Philip Schuyler for the Senate seat. And Burr was a lone operator, a protean figure who formed alliances for short-term gain. In the Senate, he was loosely allied with the Jeffersonians and was an enthusiast for the French Revolution, a stand that irked Hamilton. Then in early 1792, Burr had decided to test the waters for New York governor and challenge George Clinton's bid for a sixth term. His strategy was to enlist disaffected Clintonians and Federalists and reshuffle the political deck in New York. Afraid to adulterate his own party, Hamilton spiked this coalition and became an immovable obstacle in the path of Aaron Burr's ambitions, a position he was to occupy so frequently in future years that it finally drove Burr into a frenzy. The New York gubernatorial contest in the spring of 1792 had been one of special venom. Once Burr saw that his attempt had miscarried, he switched back, without evident discomfort, to supporting Governor Clinton. On the other side, the Federalist ticket, likely crafted by Hamilton, consisted of Chief Justice John Jay for governor, along with Stephen Van Rensselaer, Hamilton's brother-in-law, for lieutenant governor. The Federalist ticket was so identified with Hamilton that the race turned into something of a poll on his policies. The election culminated in a helpless stalemate. When votes in three upstate counties were disputed, Aaron Burr and Rufus King were asked to give opinions about the disputed ballots. Burr came down decisively on Clinton's side and handed him a controversial victory. Hamilton's friend Robert Troup was so irate that he called Burr a Clinton tool and denounced the shameful prostitution of his talents. The quibbles and chicanery made use of are characteristic of the man. Such reports only reinforced Hamilton's sense of Burr as an unscrupulous opportunist eager to exploit popular turmoil. In now opposing Burr's ambition to become vice president, Hamilton viewed him as a possible stalking horse for Governor Clinton and dispatched letters to dissuade people from backing him. Hamilton was a man of such deep, unalterable principles that Burr was bound to strike him as devoid of any moral compass. In writing to one correspondent, Hamilton even found sudden virtues in George Clinton, describing him as a man of property and probity in his private life. He couldn't say as much for Burr. "I fear the other gentleman, that is Burr, is unprincipled both as a public and private man. When the Constitution was in deliberation, his conduct was equivocal. In fact, I take it he is for or against nothing but as it suits his interest or ambition. He is determined, as I conceive, to make his way to be the head of the popular party and to climb to the highest honors of the state and as much higher as circumstances may permit. I am mistaken if it be not his object to play the game of confusion, and I feel it a religious duty to oppose his career." Hamilton denounced Burr in language similar to that he employed against Jefferson, warning that if we have an embryo Caesar in the United States, 'tis Burr. But if Jefferson was a man of fanatical principles, he had principles all the same, which Hamilton could forgive. Burr's abiding sin was a total lack of principles, which Hamilton could not forgive. Hamilton's anxieties about Burr proved premature. On October 16th, a Republican caucus in Philadelphia bestowed unanimous approval upon George Clinton's candidacy for vice president. As a professional politician, Burr was ready to concede defeat and fight another day. He graciously stepped aside. Students of the period point to this meeting as one of the first examples of party organization in American elections, though the participants were skittish about calling themselves a party. But the group's multi-state composition did reflect a new degree of political cohesion among like-minded politicians. The ringleader was the seemingly omnipresent House clerk John Beckley. Soon after the Republican caucus, Beckley described to Madison Hamilton's growing influence in electoral politics. "In the vice presidential race," Beckley said, "the Treasury Secretary's efforts, both direct and indirect, are unceasing and extraordinary. There is no inferior degree of sagacity in the combinations of this extraordinary man. With a comprehensive eye, a subtle and contriving mind, and a soul devoted to his object, all his measures are promptly and aptly designed, and, like the links of a chain, depend on each other and acquire additional strength by their union." Beckley retained an unwavering belief in Hamilton's wickedness and suggested to Madison that he had explosive new proof that might bring down the Treasury Secretary. "I think I have a clue to something far beyond mere suspicion on this ground, which prudence forbids a present disclosure of." Beckley's letter hints at early knowledge of the Reynolds affair. As always, Hamilton braced for attacks on his integrity and was prepared to squelch any slander. Early in the fall, he was advised that during a Maryland congressional campaign, incumbent John F. Mercer had impugned his conduct in office. The son of a wealthy Virginia planter, Mercer had been a former aide-de-camp to General Charles Lee, the conceited general who had been court-martialed after the Battle of Monmouth. A foe of strong central government, Mercer had been a voluble member of the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson described him as afflicted with the morbid rage of debate, and had left Philadelphia without signing the document. In his campaign oratory, Mercer renewed every hoary charge ever leveled at Hamilton. Hamilton was the tool of the propertied class, had bought back government debt at inflated prices to enrich speculators, had dictated legislation to Congress, had rewarded William Duer with a lucrative contract to supply the Western Army, and had introduced the detestable excise tax on liquor. Mercer also revived a 1790 incident in which he had met Hamilton at the door of the Treasury building and asked to be reimbursed for horses shot from under him during the Revolution. Hamilton had replied facetiously that if Mercer voted for his assumption bill, he would pay for the horses from his own pocket. Mercer presented this passing jest as proof of Hamilton's corruption. Finally, he ridiculed Hamilton as an upstart, a mushroom excrescence, who did not deserve the prominence he had gained. When it came to aspersions against his honor, Hamilton always had a hair-trigger temper. In language signaling a possible duel, Hamilton wrote testily to Mercer and asked him to disavow the charge that he had bought back government debt at inflated rates to help speculators. Mercer partially retracted his words and admitted that Hamilton had never bought government bonds for personal gain. On the other hand, he insisted that Hamilton had exerted his influence to attach to your administration a moneyed interest as an engine of government. Unable to let the matter drop, Hamilton knocked on Mercer's door in Philadelphia that December and demanded a further retraction. Hamilton got enough satisfaction. "I spoke nothing that could tend, in my opinion, to wound your honesty or integrity," Mercer conceded, that a possible duel was averted. Hamilton may have opposed duels on principle, as he later claimed, but for such a hot-headed man, these affairs of honor were expedient weapons in silencing his enemies. Whenever he was maligned, Hamilton aggressively sought retractions, persisting to the bitter end. On December 5, 1792, members of the Electoral College assembled in their respective states. The outcome gratified Hamilton and corresponded with his expectations. Washington was chosen unanimously as president. Adams received 77 votes, enough to return him as vice president, while George Clinton gained a respectable 50 votes. In his honors, always to be taken with a pound of salt, Jefferson reported that Senator John Langdon had commented to Adams on the closeness of his vote. According to Langdon, Adams gritted his teeth and exclaimed, "Damn 'em, damn 'em, damn 'em. You see that an elective government will not do." On the surface, the election seemed an impressive show of national unity when it was just a passing truce in an ongoing war. For the last time, George Washington's prestige papered over growing differences between Hamiltonians and Jeffersonians. 3 days after the Electoral College met, James Monroe resumed his newspaper defense of Jefferson and slammed Hamilton as someone suspected with too much reason to be attached to monarchy. Far more noteworthy than such hackneyed tirades against Hamilton, however, were the first shots fired at Washington. No longer a sacred figure, immune to criticism, he was spattered with mud by Philip Freneau, who accused him of aping royalty in his presidential etiquette. A certain monarchical prettiness must be highly extolled, such as levees, drawing rooms, stately nods instead of shaking hands, titles of office, seclusion from the people. Given Washington's reluctance to serve a second term, this was an especially undeserved cut, and Adams lamented the sour, angry, peevish, fretful, lying paragraphs with which the press battered the government. Clearly, the political tone in Washington's second term was going to be even harsher than in the first. Right before Christmas, Hamilton wrote a despairing letter to John Jay. He was worn down by the interminable attacks against him and slander he felt powerless to stop. He told Jay that he was oppressed by the weight of official business and the need to track legislative maneuvers against him, but that his burden and perplexity had still more sinister origins. "'Tis the malicious intrigues to stab me in the dark, against which I am too often obliged to guard myself, that distract and harass me to a point which, rendering my situation scarcely tolerable, interferes with objects to which friendship and inclination would prompt me." Hamilton wrote this cheerless assessment 3 days after meeting with Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe. He must have known the Mariah Reynolds affair would have repercussions for many years to come. As Washington's first term ended in early 1793, the president remained distraught over his bickering cabinet. He continued to admonish his headstrong secretaries of Treasury and State that they should try to get along for the national good. Jefferson assured the president that he would strive for unity and that he had kept myself aloof from all cabal and correspondence on the subject of the government. In the next breath, however, he renewed his corrosive attacks on Hamilton. Washington's vaunted patience was giving way to petulant flashes of temper, and, according to Jefferson, he expressed the extreme wretchedness of his existence while in office and went lengthily into the late attacks on him for levies. This was an implicit rebuke of Jefferson, for it was Freneau who had accused Washington of holding royal levies or receptions. Even as Jefferson mouthed sedative pledges of peace, he and Madison were secretly orchestrating the first concerted effort in American history to expel a cabinet member for official misconduct. They had come to regard Hamilton as a grave threat to Republican government, a monarchist bent on destroying the Republic, all without any proof. The National Gazette put it that Hamilton fancies himself the great pivot upon which the whole machine of government turns, throwing out of view the president, the legislature, and the Constitution itself. Jefferson and Madison abandoned any residual restraint as they prepared to launch an all-out inquisition. To disguise their efforts, they employed as their surrogate a fiery Virginia congressman, William Branch Giles, who later courted one of Jefferson's daughters. As early as the spring of 1792, Hamilton had suspected intrigue within the Virginia delegation and identified Madison as the prompter of Mr. Giles and others who were the open instruments of opposition. The husky, often unkempt Giles was a Princeton graduate and noted Virginia lawyer. He shared his state's endemic hatred of banks and modern finance and thought a northern faction was out to destroy the Union. As a frequent mouthpiece for Jefferson, he employed his pugnacious style for states' rights and did not spare anyone in the Federalist opposition. He even accused Washington of showing a princely ignorance of the country, evidenced by the fact that the wants and wishes of one part had been sacrificed to the interest of the other. Giles tried to discredit Hamilton over his use of money that the government had borrowed in Europe. This charge originated in a memo that Jefferson had prepared surreptitiously for Madison. Hamilton had wanted to use foreign loans to repay a government loan from the Bank of the United States, $2 million that the bank had extended to the federal government to purchase stock in the bank itself. Partial as ever to the French Revolution, the Jeffersonians feared that this money would be diverted from American debt payments to France. In the past, Hamilton had applied foreign loans to the repayment of domestic debt, a technical violation of the law, but one, he claimed, that had been approved verbally by Washington. The suspicion prevailed among critics, however, that he wanted to transfer borrowed funds from Europe to the National Bank to aid speculators. And a small circle of opponents, including Jefferson and Madison, now also knew about the denouement of the Mariah Reynolds affair, with its accusations of official wrongdoing by Hamilton. Twice in late December 1792, the House demanded from Hamilton a strict accounting of foreign loans. Distracted by the Reynolds probe, he still managed to crank out a detailed report by January 3rd. The beleaguered Hamilton felt the weight of unseen forces marshaled against him and feared he was now the target of a highly organized attempt to destroy his reputation. Planning to exhaust Hamilton, Giles submitted 5 resolutions in the House on January 23rd, calling for still more extensive information on foreign loans. By design, these resolutions made massive, nay, overwhelming demands on Hamilton. He had to furnish a complete reckoning of balances between the government and the central bank, as well as a comprehensive list of sinking fund purchases of government debt. Some historians, including Giles's biographer, believe that Jefferson instigated these resolutions, with Madison drafting their language. Taking advantage of a short, 4-month congressional session, the House gave Hamilton an impossible March 3rd deadline. Republicans hoped that Hamilton's failure to comply would then be construed as prima facie evidence of his guilt. Federalists were equally convinced that he would prove to be incorruptible. Hamilton's critics seriously underrated his superhuman stamina. He enjoyed beating his enemies at their own game, and the resolutions roused his fighting spirit. By February 19th, in a staggering display of diligence, he delivered to the House several copious reports, garlanded with tables, lists, and statistics that gave a comprehensive overview of his work as Treasury Secretary. In the finale of one 20,000-word report, Hamilton intimated that he had risked a physical breakdown to complete this heroic labor. "It is certain that I have made every exertion in my power, at the hazard of my health, to comply with the requisitions of the House as early as possible." Hamilton's reports did not sway his opponents, who wanted to expose him, not engage him in debate. Every proof of his prodigious gifts made him seem only the more threatening. Defying Washington's appeal for a truce with Hamilton, Jefferson intensified the combat at close quarters. On February 25th, he proposed to Washington an official inquiry into Hamilton and the Treasury Department, a demand Washington spurned bluntly. Hamilton thought Jefferson should leave the cabinet and openly head the opposition, rather than subvert the administration from within. In response, Thomas Jefferson did something extraordinary. he drew up a series of resolutions censuring Hamilton and quietly slipped them to William Branch Giles. Jefferson now functioned as de facto leader of the Republican Party. The great irony was that the man who repeatedly accused Hamilton of meddling with Congress and violating the separation of powers was now secretly scrawling congressional resolutions directed against a member of his own administration. When Giles filed 9 censure resolutions against Hamilton in late February, he did not disclose that they were based on Jefferson's rough draft. The telltale document did not even surface until 1895. Giles introduced his charges with what one spectator described as a most pointed attack on Hamilton. The resolutions accused Hamilton of indecorum in dealing with Congress and of improperly mixing foreign and domestic loans. Giles omitted 2 of the more outlandish resolutions drawn up by Jefferson, a claim that Hamilton had attempted to benefit speculators and a demand that the treasurer's office be hived off from the rest of the Treasury Department. 1 Jefferson resolution exposed the true intent behind his vendetta. "Resolved that the Secretary of the Treasury has been guilty of maladministration in the duties of his office and should, in the opinion of Congress, be removed from his office by the President of the United States." By submitting these resolutions on the eve of the congressional recess, Giles intended to deprive Hamilton of adequate time to rebut the charges. Despite Madison's support, the House roundly voted down these resolutions. Jefferson anticipated this defeat, but knew that the unsubstantiated accusations would float tantalizingly in the air. As he observed, the resolutions would enable people to see from this the extent of their danger. The upshot of the abortive Republican campaign was an almost total vindication of Hamilton. All 9 of the Virginians' resolutions were defeated on March 1st. At worst, Hamilton was found guilty of excessive discretion in shifting money among accounts to ensure that the government did not miss interest payments. He also was not always meticulous in matching specific loans to the laws authorizing them, but nobody ever proved that Alexander Hamilton had diverted a penny of public money for personal profit. Federalists rejoiced that the Republican vendetta had backfired, and 1 Boston Federalist exclaimed, "The conquest to the cause of government and the reputation of Hamilton must be as glorious as it was unexpected." Hamilton, however, foresaw further attacks. "There is no doubt in my mind," he told Rufus King, "that the next session will revive the attack with more system and earnestness." By this point, harassment was exacting a terrible physical and mental toll on the exhausted Hamilton. Sometimes he vented his rage in essays that he let molder in his drawer. In 1 unpublished essay, he railed against the Jeffersonians as wily hypocrites and crafty and abandoned impostors. He now viewed hypocrisy and treachery as the most successful commodities in the political market. "It seems to be the destined lot of nations to mistake their foes for their friends, their flatterers for their faithful servants." He believed that he had made a huge but thankless sacrifice for his country. Hamilton was correct that Jefferson and his cohorts had no intention of desisting in their attacks. He now discovered that Muhlenberg, Venable, or Monroe, or perhaps all 3, had breached the vow of confidentiality in the Reynolds affair. In early May 1793, Hamilton's old friend from Revolutionary days, Henry Lee, wrote from Virginia, "Was I with you, I would talk an hour with doors bolted and windows shut, as my heart is much afflicted by some whispers which I have heard." The vindication of Hamilton by Congress only strengthened the faith of the Jeffersonians that legislators could never exercise independent judgment when it came to him. Jefferson now asked John Beckley to provide him with a list of papermen, that is, congressmen who held bank stock or government bonds. The supposed conflicts of interest of these legislators gave Jefferson the all-purpose explanation he needed to explain Hamilton's acquittal. Madison, too, ascribed the defeated resolutions to corrupt congressmen who had profited from Hamilton's fiscal measures. At this stage, it grew more and more evident to Jefferson that he would have to perpetuate the struggle against the Treasury Secretary, not from inside the government, but from the safe haven of Monticello. In the wake of their setback, Republicans seeking more damaging information about Hamilton latched on to a disgruntled former Treasury Department clerk named Andrew Francis. At first glance, he seemed like a magnificent find, an angry man with inside knowledge of Hamilton's official duties. He had labored at the Treasury Department from its formation in 1789 until he was fired in March 1793. After moving to New York City, Francis was short of money and longed to retaliate against Hamilton. In May 1793, he presented to the Treasury two warrants for redemption that dated back to the early Confederation period. In the first days of the new government, Treasury officials had routinely honored these claims, but they later declined automatic payment as they discovered how slipshod had been the paperwork of their predecessors. As a one-time Treasury employee, Francis knew this history. Nonetheless, when his claims were denied, he protested that he was being penalized by the Treasury Secretary, and he pestered both Hamilton and Washington for payment. In early June, Francis not only returned to Philadelphia, but accosted Hamilton, who told him to renew his claim in writing. End of Disc 17.